Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Featuring stimulating in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative and explore whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects. And for this, the arts hour, I feature in-depth interviews with local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And I combine a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. Well, this week, my special guest from the arts is renowned artist Emilia Kabakov of the artistic duo Ilya and Emilia Kabakov, who are regularly named among the top 10 living artists in the world. American curator, writer and painter Robert Storr considers Ilya and Emilia Kabakov to be the two most consequential artists to emerge from Russia since the 1920s. This is the second in a two-part series of interviews with Emilia Kabakov. If you'd like to hear the other part, you can visit the show's website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. Go to the guest page and click on Emilia Kabakov Part 1. There'll be a little photo of her with Part 1 underneath. And you'll be able to hear our first conversation. But today we'll be talking about the Kabakov's latest exhibition, Not Everyone Will Be Taken Into the Future. The exhibition is currently in Russia, where it's being shown at the State Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg and the State Tretyakov Gallery in Moscow. I was fortunate to be in London when the exhibition was at Tate Modern prior to it moving to Russia. And it's the first major museum exhibition in the UK of the Kabakov's work, coinciding with the 100th anniversary this year of the Bolshevik Revolution. And the exhibition explores the Kabakov's pioneering place in the international story of conceptual art. It's a huge exhibition unfolding over 3,600 square feet at Tate Modern and includes paintings by Ilya, drawings, albums, architectural models and large installations. Tate Modern curator Juliet Bingham observes, "The exhibition Not Everyone Will Be Taken Into the Future and the work of the same name, a train departing from a railway platform that is strewn with discarded paintings, signals fundamental questions posed by the artists concerning the relationship to the past, the artist's place in society, the value of art and the future reception of an artist's work." We'll also be talking about what utopia embodies for the Kabakovs, what painting offers different from installations, whether art should be life-affirming, if there's a spiritual aspect to their work, their recurring use of the metaphor of flight, and how much the context of an artwork matters, and much, much more, of course. Well, Ilya and Emilia Kabakov have worked together in the USA where they live since the late 1980s, and they're known for their complex, large-scale projects and immersive total installations. To date, together, they've created nearly 200 of these total installations, which invite the viewer to become an active part of the work and consider the meaning of such things as utopia, the place of the artist, power, hope, fear, escapism, fantasy, and much more. Both Ilya and Emilia received formal education in the arts in the Soviet Union. Ilya's background is in graphic design and painting, and his early work consisted of small paintings, drawings, and installations. He shunned becoming an official Soviet fine artist because of the limiting artistic scope that was mandated at that time, and so instead he worked as a children's book illustrator, whilst at the same time creating artworks privately, which were shown to a small community of fellow artists. A gifted pianist, Emilia studied music, Spanish language and literature, and after settling in New York, worked as a curator and art advisor. And they knew each other growing up, and Emilia and Ilya met up again when Ilya moved to the USA, and they've been creating conceptual artworks together since 1989, and they've been married since 1992. And I'm very appreciative of Emilia making the time to talk to me for this two-part interview series, as when she spoke to me, she was just getting ready to leave for Russia to reinstall the Not Everyone Will Be Taken Into the Future exhibition, which is a truly epic task with an exhibition of this size and quality and making it fit into a completely different space. So very grateful to her for making the time to talk to me. Well, let's hear some of our conversation. You have a major exhibition at the moment, Not Everyone Will Be Taken Into the Future. And the exhibition has been described as exploring the theme of failed utopia. And in a simple way, this could be seen as the Soviet Union. But I'm wondering whether you see the exhibition as exploring a wider failed utopia, maybe America or the West or the 20th century.
The 20th century had a lot of utopia. If we look back, it's not only Soviet Union. It's fascism, it's communism, it's socialism, and it's capitalism as well.
Mm.
All of them fail.
Yes.
By the end, all of them were supposed to be utopian countries, happy, when people live happily ever after.
Mm.
Never of them actually realize its full potential. Because utopia, if you translate, it's something which is impossible to achieve, impossible to realize. And maybe we shouldn't look for utopia. We just have to create normal life for everybody so people don't kill each other.
Yes.
Don't destroy each other's life. Don't look at each other like the other person doesn't matter.
Mm. So I was going to ask what utopia embodies for you. Is it largely about tolerance and really seeing each other?
Utopia is when mostly you are happy and you have friends and you have books and the bomb doesn't fall on your head and nobody put you to jail.
Yeah.
And it's normality of life. We don't appreciate this unless we get into scary situations.
Yeah, yeah, that's very true. Yeah. The exhibition includes quite a few paintings, and Ilya produced a lot of painted works, then rejected painting but embraced it again as of the 2000s. You spoke earlier about how installations are a kind of three-dimensional painting. I'm wondering what you feel painting perhaps offers that doesn't come through in an installation.
No, in a way, he never rejected painting. It was just verbally. He was saying painting is not matter anymore, but he wasn't only one at that time.
Mm.
A lot of artists were saying painting run its course, we know what it is, it's not enough for us.
Mm.
And start doing different things, including video, performance, a lot of things was there in the 60s, 70s. He always was doing painting, he kept doing them, but what he did, he integrated them into installation. So mostly why people doesn't know that he was doing painting, because they hidden an installation, let's say.
Right,
there are many, many installations with paintings. There are some installations with 14, 15 paintings, with 3, 2, 11, whatever. And that's the reason when sometimes even professionals, like art critic, especially when they're not very well informed about what we're doing, think that Kabakov dropped doing paintings and start installation, and then all of a sudden he starts working on paintings and he doesn't know how to make paintings. Somebody even said to me, but he doesn't know how to paint. He just wastes the, paints, which is true. He's a professionally trained painter. He absolutely knows. But what they do forget, he's a conceptual artist.
Yes.
Installation or no installation, painting or no installation, no painting. Concept comes first.
Right. Yes.
Even if it's conceptual painting, doesn't matter what on this painting, you have to look for a concept.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. After Tate Modern London, the Not Everyone Will Be Taken Into the Future exhibition is going to the State Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg and then the State Tretyakov Gallery in Moscow. What does it mean to you and Ilya to have this exhibition in Russia where you know, for a long time your work wasn't appreciated?
Well, we already had exhibition in St. Petersburg at Hermitage, 2003. And first time it was like a dream. It was surreal because it was the first time we come back to Russia. And Nilia said, we don't give any interviews. We decide not to give any interviews because we had the possibility to say, you know, this is a dream. This is not real.
Yeah.
And everybody was, journalists were screaming at us because they didn't understand why we don't want to talk.
Yes.
And at that time, we just want to taste the waters. Is it safe to talk or not safe to talk? Or we didn't know what to say. We didn't know the public yet. It changed. Now it's a different story. It's the first time Tate worked with major Russian museums. And unfortunately, the situation changed during this few months, weeks, dramatically.
Yes.
And a lot of people canceling, you know, the visit to Russia. And it's so strange and it's so difficult at this moment to understand what's going on. There's so many things going on. And it's like, oh, you know, everything changed all over again.
Yeah.
It's kind of deja vu. You look back and what's going on?
Yeah.
We create enemies, both countries.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more than both countries. Yes. England, too. So, like, the world right now separating. We were under, you know, in the situation of global communication, global connection, trades, everything, and all of a sudden every country right now split into a little cave, and every tribe is going inside the cave and closed and shut the doors.
Yes.
We put a big stone in front of our entrance, so you can't get out and you can't get in.
Yeah.
And this is very dangerous for the
world. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And I think it's always disconcerting how, you know, so few people can create such a negative impact. You know, if you look at the sort of heads of countries and see what they're doing and the amazing negative impact they can have, that, you know, can be very depressing. But then I always try and remember that if one person can have that much bad impact, then one person can also have that much good impact.
Well, we are lucky in America because we actually can change people every 4 years.
Yes.
We have to understand, we have to remember that. Other countries have become totalitarian regimes again all around the world. I can tell a lot and I can see it.
Yes.
Totalitarianism is back.
Yeah.
And that's dangerous.
Yes.
That's very dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think, you know, that's where art can really be powerful in creating connections where there might not seem to be. And I hope your exhibition might be able to still do that, you know, even though...
Well, I agree on a lot of public appearances every evening with the young people, with the students, with different clubs. And I usually don't do this. And it's only... I'm taking a chance, but it's only for one reason. I would really like to talk about situation and explain that, you know what, politics is politics, but we're all human.
Yes.
And cultural relation has to stay. Otherwise, we don't have a chance to survive.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And we have to think about our children.
Yes.
You know, in my case, it's even my grandchildren. So.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There's a poignancy and a terrible vulnerability to being an artist, because the artist doesn't know if the work will even be seen at all, let alone endure after they've gone. And this is addressed in your specific installation, Not Everyone Will Be Taken Into the Future, after which the current exhibition is named. It's a long time since you and Ilya have been in that position, but I'm wondering how you dealt with it originally, the possibility that your art might not be appreciated or endure.
Nobody can give you guarantee, you know. It's like life. Nobody can guarantee you where you're born, how you're born, why you're born, and what's going to happen to you during life and after life. Art is the same way.
Yes. Yeah.
It just come to you, it's enveloped you, and nobody can give you guarantee that you will be famous or rich, or your art will survive or will be taken into the future. So artists always have doubts about it. And it's maybe provoke you to create more, maybe it provoke you to try to become better, but that's life also like this.
Yes, yeah. So you just have to kind of live with that and maybe channel it into your artistic process.
You do what you're supposed to do and you do what you can do and hope it's enough.
Yes, yeah. Roger Catlin of Smithsonian.com describes you and Elia creating worlds of whimsy and delight. There's a school of thought that we must put away childish things and only present the world as it actually is, often sort of grim reality. And yet this relegates a huge proportion of life experience to insignificance, and it also makes a value judgment on each person's perception of their own reality. Your work deals with some quite difficult things, but you do it in a way that's humanistic and hopeful. Do you feel art should be life-affirming, even if it deals with difficult subjects or emotions?
We created a way that we can't live only in reality. We always have to have a dream. We always have to have a dream about utopia, about better life, about different worlds, about different people, something which keep us higher than common everyday level of life.
Mm.
That's what makes life worth living. We believe in this. So people in the ancient time create God and create paradise.
Mm.
But that would happen only after you die. Later, people want to have this paradise on earth, and that's why all these isms were created. They don't materialize, but we still create something new. So maybe internet is a way of our believing in future.
Mm.
Maybe we want to be connected. We believe in interconnection.
Mm.
We believe in the better future when everybody will be friendly and know each other and communicate freely and, you know, get pleasure out of this communication.
Mm.
Not be afraid of each other.
Mm.
That's...
Yeah.
Art helps a lot.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, renowned conceptual artist Emilia Kabakoff of the artistic duo Elia and Emilia Kabakoff, regularly named among the top 10 living artists in the world. We're going to a break now, but I'll be back with more of my conversation with Emilia after these messages.
Do you like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
No white horses to play the game, and I wish I knew your name. Something about you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, babe, it just goes nowhere. Well, we can do the things we want. We can do the things we like. But if we're taking all the time, well, I just don't think that it's right. Just that. I think that there's more to us than just that.
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz has been an independent bookseller for over half a century in the community we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown. We love our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, online and in downtown Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, artist Emilia Kabakov of the world-famous artistic duo Elia and Emilia Kabakov. We heard from Bookshop Santa Cruz in the break, and I wanted to let you know they have a regular program of wonderful authors appearing. Coming up on Monday, June 25th at 7 p.m, Bookshop Santa Cruz welcomes marine conservationist Jonathan White for a reading and signing of his new book, Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. This free event is co-sponsored by the Santa Cruz Museum of Natural History. In his award-winning book, Tides, writer, sailor and surfer Jonathan White takes readers on a journey of discovery around the globe to witness the largest, fastest, scariest and most amazing tides in the world. White travels to California to shadow the Mavericks competition, where surfers paddle into deadly waves 60 feet high, to the Arctic to shimmy down a hole in the ice with an Inuit elder, to the Qiantang River in China to witness the Silver Dragon, which is a 25-foot tidal bore that crashes its way up the 80-mile river, to Mont-Saint-Michel, France, to learn how the monks were inspired by the tide, and to the Royal Society of London, where he discovers how Plato and Aristotle, Leonardo da Vinci, Newton, Descartes, among others, have all been captivated by the tide. Sounds like a fascinating book, and this free event is a great opportunity to meet its author, Jonathan White. So that's Monday, June 25th at 7 p.m. More information at bookshopsantacruz.com. Well, back to my guest this week, artist Emilia Kabakov of art duo Elia and Emilia Kabakov. And just to let you know, if you go to the show website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, I'll be putting up a podcast page for this show with photographs of the Kabakovs' work, photographs of their latest exhibition, and links to their website, and also a link to their inspiring art installation project with children around the world, The Ship of Tolerance. And you can also listen to the first part of this interview series with Emilia there as well. If you go to itsaquestionofbalance.com and then click on the guest page, you'll see Emilia's photograph, part one. Click on there and it'll take you to our first conversation. But right now, let's hear some more from Emilia. There are indications that participation in art can have a tangible positive effects emotionally and psychologically. I myself designed and conducted a funded clinical research study into the effects of arts on creativity, health and well-being. And there's a psychologist I really admire, Alice Miller, who studied artists in depth, and she considered that art could help process trauma. I'm wondering if you feel art can have a healing effect both on those creating the art and those experiencing it.
Art definitely heal people. I always say if Hitler would become an artist, they probably wouldn't be the fascism and war. But yeah. Somebody didn't understand this. They reject his painting. I actually called his painting at some point. Somebody brought them to America to sell. I refused to keep them or even try to show it to somebody, but actually I did to look at the painting. He was very mediocre, but even mediocre artist, if he would become an artist, his fantasies would go into a different direction.
Yes.
And his thoughts too. He would be dreaming about conquering the world with his art, but not in real life. So twisted mind sometimes can be distracted from destruction by creating something positive. And that's art and music and literature and poetry and many, many other things which we don't appreciate enough.
Yes.
They're very powerful.
Yeah, yeah. And sadly, I think, you know, with investment in the arts, it's always seen as something that can just be, you know, taken out of the budget, whether it's in education or in the public sector. It's just seen as a kind of luxury, and I think that's so sad because I think it's vital.
It's a necessity. This is not a luxury. This is a necessity. If we want the world to be better, if we want our children to be smart, successful, talented, we have to explore this. We have to give them this chance.
Yeah.
And that takes money, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah.
And public education is the best way to do it. And
people
have to think about it seriously and not let anybody to tell them differently.
Yes, yeah. Well, I think, you know, the return of investment is looked at as, you know, well, what kind of job will they get? But it's not about that. The return on investment is how they will be as people.
Yes. Yeah. It's about their life.
Yeah, yeah. You've said the life of you and Ilya consists of your work, dreams and discussions, and that you manage to transform reality into fantasy and permanently stay there. I was wondering what fantasy means to you.
We live in a dream world, you know.
Mm.
Because we are able, we're given possibility to do what we want, and it's not about money. We are lucky enough that we can survive and we can make living with our art. But even without money, without success, because, you know, we're not the most commercial, we're not commercial artists, we're not the richest artists. Mm. On this level, probably many other artists have more money. But it never was about money. Mm. It never was about somebody collecting and paying for it. It was always about getting pleasure, making your dreams and fantasies realized. And it's, of course, it's about art. What do you do? What do you want to do? Oh, my God, this is another project. Let's try to do it. So, in a way, the Ship of Tolerance is one of such a fantasy projects.
Mm.
We had another one, the Palace of Project, which was very difficult to make because it was expensive. We made it.
Mm.
It's permanently built. We have a lot of public projects all around the world, unfortunately not in the United States for some reason.
Mm.
Practicality took over in this country for a while.
Mm.
But many, Japan, Italy, Germany especially, we have approximately all around like 70 public projects by now.
Yeah.
And they're all not about reality. They're all kind of fantasy. And common people who work very hard every day in their life, they do love this project.
Yes, yeah. Do you think when you create a work of art, it can be embedded with a meaning that's beyond the conscious awareness of the artist, what the artist intended? And if you do, where would you think that meaning comes from?
I don't know. Frankly, not me. I can't say that I know everything. No, I don't know.
What? Come on.
No.
I feel very let down. No, I'm just joking.
No. Probably. That's why people like it.
Yeah.
But I don't know for sure.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Mondrian and Kandinsky felt that art should provide people with a spiritual element. I'm wondering what your feelings are on this and whether it's sort of implicit anyway in a work of art or whether it's...
How to Meet an Angel. We have a project which is How to Meet an Angel, and it exists in reality because we already built it. Do we believe in meeting an angel? Of course we do.
Mm.
Try to prove me wrong.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is striking about the universe is the worlds within worlds. And as humans, we're exactly at the midpoint between large and small in the known universe. You know, there's as many things smaller than us than there are bigger than us, at least that we know about right now. And you explore this somewhat in your installations, such as Where Is Our Place, which plays with different types of viewers, giants, subterranean beings, gallery visitors, and the little white men, the tiny paper cutouts in various works. Our human viewpoint can be quite totalitarian in many ways. I'm wondering, is it important to you in your work to challenge the usual viewpoint and our sense of our place in the world?
There is so many perspectives in human life, in religion, in the conditions of life, and everything, and art and literature and politics. As many as there are people in this world, so many perspectives and opinions we have. For us, it's important that freedom of these opinions exists, because otherwise, we can't. You know, even if you look at children, they're all different.
Yes,
we try to tell them share the choice, but not always they want to share, and we have to leave them alone and let them come to the conclusion if they want to share or not to share. We teach them, we tell them, but we tell them what to do.
Yes.
And the same with adults, unfortunately.
The same with the adults, yes. Yeah.
Yes. have to decide by themselves what they're doing in this life, what kind of opinion they're going to have. Is this opinion matter? Is it right or wrong?
Yeah.
I would say, talking about religion, the Ten Commandments was a very important thing, and that's kind of stabilize and give the foundation for the rest of our lives.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at the basic tenets of the monotheistic religions, you know, particularly if you look also at the New Testament, if you just look at the Sermon on the Mount, you know, it's basically just love yourself, love everyone, love God. And, you know, it's kind of that simple, but somehow
it's not even love God. It's don't do things to others that you don't want to be done to you.
Right, yes.
Don't take something that doesn't belong to you. Don't do bad things to other people.
Yes.
Respect them. In general, that's exactly what we want from this life. That's exactly what we how we want to be treated.
Yes.
So we have to treat other people the same way.
Yeah, the golden rule, I think, is if everybody lived by that, then the world...
We will probably build the utopia then.
Yes, yeah.
That would be, then we could realize it's okay. Doesn't matter how we're going to call it, but it would be utopia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I'm still hopeful that we might get there. Maybe not, and maybe not in our lifetime, but sometime. The metaphor of flight recurs in your works. What's significant about flight for you and Ilya?
Escapism. Mm. In one way, it's possibility of dream. So you're flying, and we can't fly. But if you're dreaming about flying, that's your dream, that's your fantasy, you are free. It's about freedom.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's about escaping from reality, from suppression, from dangers. You can fly, and you can fly away from everything.
Yeah. And I think also with flight, you then have the power to go where you want also. It's not just escaping. It allows you
no,
to go places.
It's a freeing of everything, yes. Yeah. It gives you enormous possibilities to explore, to fantasize, to go anywhere you want in this world or beyond the world. And it doesn't matter if it's in your dream or reality.
Yeah, yeah. Many of your works have referred to the Soviet era. How much does a viewer need to be aware of the context of a work of art to be fully affected by it? I know you spoke about the installation earlier where people, you know, didn't understand that it was about the history of art. Do you think if you do understand the context, you're going to get a lot more out of it, or is it just different?
I think it's very important to have a context, to know the context. Otherwise, it's very difficult to understand in many cases.
Mm.
We don't work with Soviet thematics for a very long time, but we do work with narrative because this is kind of Russian culture, and that's how we grow up in Russian culture. It's the base of our existence and our culture, personal cultural development. So if people in the West doesn't understand the context of our work, it's quite difficult for them to understand the work itself.
Mm.
So it's much simpler to say, okay, this artist worked with communal apartment or Soviet reality, and that's it. You put a label, like brand these people, and for the rest of their life, that's what they're doing. But as you know, we don't do just Soviet life or Soviet apartment or communal apartment. By the way, I just read an article that in California, San Francisco, they start building communal apartments.
Oh, wow.
So welcome to Soviet life.
Mm.
It's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
People living in the same apartment, a lot of bedrooms, very small, one toilet, one kitchen, one bathroom.
Hmm. Interesting.
Because that's what they can afford. You didn't read it?
No, okay. No, but I can see that happening. It's so expensive to live here. Yeah.
Yeah. I just read it and I was so surprised.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's so important, though, for each person to have a sense of individual space, that whole thing, Virginia Woolf, of you know, a room of one's own, you know, to somewhere to be separate. It's very important, I think, to process life and be able to then be with other people.
Yes.
That it's a bit worrying, yeah. To
each one of us, despite being a communal person, it's also individual, and that's require space. What always strikes me from the very beginning I come to the West, it's the space between you and the other person. Everybody protects their personal space.
Yeah.
And everybody understands that the other person has personal space which they can't physically invade.
Mm.
It's absolutely not like this in Eastern Bloc. Uh-huh. When people talk to you, they go into your face, very close physically. Mm. And I'm, you know, spending 45 years in the West, I'm very uncomfortable with it.
Yes.
So when people start moving in my direction, I actually retreat.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's my you're invading my personal space.
Yes. Yeah. Hmm. That's interesting. And I suppose if you grow up with that, then it's still having an effect on you, which is probably not good, but you wouldn't even really know, would you? Because that's all that you've ever had is people being like right in your space all the time.
They don't understand. And in a way, it's not physically acceptable. It's very difficult if you're not used to it.
Yes.
And I'm not used to it anymore. It's, you know...
Yeah.
You feel dangerous, you feel uncomfortable emotionally and physically and mentally. It's complete invasion.
Yeah.
You want to retreat right away, you want to disappear.
Yeah.
That's the moment when you want to fly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think just that very thing can create a lot of difficult emotions and perhaps even aggression just simply because someone's in your space. And if you're not aware of that happening,
yeah, you can accept it as an aggression. Yes,
exactly. Yeah, you just think I feel angry or whatever, and you don't even realize what
it's a dominant attitude. I dominate your space, so I dominate you.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
They don't realize this. It's unconsciously done. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, artist Emilia Kabakov of world-renowned artistic duo Ilya and Emilia Kabakov. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back right after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Danielle and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda Yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Coplin, and my special guest this week, artist Emilia Kabakoff of art duo Ilya and Emilia Kabakoff, who are regularly named among the top 10 living artists in the world, and whom American curator, writer and painter Robert Storr considers to be the two most consequential artists to emerge from Russia since the 1920s. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, this is the second part of a two-part series of interviews with Emilia Kabakoff. So I encourage you to check out the first part of the series by visiting the guest page at the show website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. And in the first conversation that we had, we talk about when Ilya and Emilia first became aware of the power of art to affect us on a deep level, how they go about working together on their installations, their early life in Russia, how they knew each other as children, why they started creating total installations, and also we talk about their wonderful art installation project with children around the world, the Ship of Tolerance. And so if you go to itsaquestionofbalance.com and you click on the guests tab, that'll bring up the page of all the guests. There'll be a little photograph of Emilia and part one. If you click on that, it'll take you to the podcast page. And I really recommend checking out their website and the Ship of Tolerance website. And the links to those will be both on the podcast page for this show and for the first part conversation as well. And if you go to the podcast page for today's show, there'll be photos from the exhibition Not Everyone Will Be Taken Into the Future, and also the audio. So if you've enjoyed this interview, you can listen to it again, or you can maybe tell your friends about it and send them to the podcast page. So again, it's a question of balance.com guests page, and then click on Emilia's photo and it will take you to the podcast page. Well, let's hear the last part of our conversation now. I was so grateful to be in London when your exhibition was on and experience your work. And it's so important to experience art in the flesh, in reality, because that's where the true energy of the work lies. You know, reproductions can only give us a partial idea. However, buying art's not possible for most people. And you know, once art goes into private collections, it's not always possible to see it very much. I'm wondering what you think about government investment in art to make it available to the general public, whether that's something you think is really important.
I don't know. I think it's very important, art education. I think it's very important. Maybe government shouldn't so much invest in the art, because look what happened in France. Government supports the artists, and there is no great artist coming out of France for a long time.
Interesting.
Because people get very lazy. They actually don't try to achieve anything.
Right.
They have everything they need. They have a studio government give them. They have some kind of amount of money which they could buy supply and they could live nicely. That's it. It's skill, creativity. So obviously you have to struggle a little bit to achieve something. Also, I do believe that when all the situation, when artists being very young, put in the public, in front of public eye, that destroys the artists.
Yeah.
They don't have experience. They don't have knowledge of anything. They don't even understand completely what they're doing. All of a sudden they become superstar and they have retrospective when they're 25 years old. Dangerous.
Yeah, no, those are very good points. So how can art be available to the public
education,
then?
Education has to be first done very well. More exhibition. It was very good system in Germany because they have Kunsthalle and Kunstvereins, which was a government institution created on public money, on government money. When they put young artists, they put controversial art, and people will come, no tickets, it's for free. And that's how they become familiar with contemporary art. Not at the museum right away, not at this buying at the gallery, but through these non-profit institutions. And curator will travel and go into studios of young artists and choosing whom they're going to present there. That gives young artists possibility to be visible and also stimulate them, not in the sense that, okay, I'm going to be rich and famous, but in the sense, oh my God, somebody is better than I have to create better. I have to come up with something more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good system.
Yeah. No, that is a good point.
Public projects is a very good system, even if it's not always paid by the government. It could be paid from public, you know, private money.
Yes.
There is a lot of charities, there's a lot of institutions, non-profit and foundations, which support public art. That's very important.
Yeah, yeah. Historically, it's been so hard for women to be seen in society, and the art world is no different. Women artists have been sidelined, and the art world is still dominated by men. I'm wondering if you've seen a change in how women artists are regarded over your career so far.
I would always prefer not to judge art by gender or race. I prefer to judge it as either good art or bad art.
Right.
And doesn't matter who made it. But of course it has to be, woman has to be shown. But not because they're women, but because they're good artists.
Yes. Yeah.
That's also important. Otherwise we, you know.
Yeah, no, I agree, absolutely. Of course, you know, in the past,
that's come from tolerance. That doesn't come from, you are a woman, you have a right to exhibit. No, you are a woman, or you are different color, or you are different race, whatever, but you're a good artist. You deserve to be exhibited.
Yes.
And we don't notice who you are.
Yeah.
We don't have to know who you are. We had once exhibition created, there was a very famous curator in he was Swiss, but he was working in Germany, in Frankfurt. And what he did, every artist made a drawing, and he exhibited drawings at the museum without names. So visitors could buy drawings just judging by quality. And there was Louis Bourgeois and Bruce Neumann and we, and, you know, all famous artists together with very young artists whom nobody knows. And people were running around buying drawings, what they like, what they think are better, without knowing the artist. So somebody bought Louis Bourgeois for $25. Each drawing cost $25. You could buy Louis Bourgeois for $25. You can buy Kabakov for $25. Or you can buy, you know, somebody who is 22 years old and nobody knows who he is. That was a brilliant idea.
Yeah. Yeah, that is. I like that. Yeah. Because the currency of art is a completely different thing to art itself. And once you have that price tag on something, I think it's very hard to not make a value judgment affected by that. I think,
yeah, but you know, people become so nervous. They start standing in line at 6 o'clock in the morning for this exhibition. During the exhibition, let's say one person was standing by the drawing and screaming to his wife, "Pay for it! Pay for it! I think it's a fantastic. It's somebody's very famous." And buy the $25, and then discover it. No, it wasn't famous, but you really like it, so you didn't overpay.
Yes,
you like the drawing.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting relationship, you know, between monetary value and actual intrinsic value. I think it's the same with age. You know, we always want to know how old people are, but it's like, what do you think you'll know about somebody when you have a number associated with them? You know, it seems hard for us to just experience things and make value judgments in that way rather than in a more worldly way. Yeah. Yeah. Robert Storr has said that you and Ilya are the two most consequential artists to emerge from Russia since the 1920s. I'm wondering what that means for you and what consequences you dream and hope for your art.
I don't know. You have to ask Robert Storr. Not me.
Okay, well then I will ask you, what motivates you to keep creating new works? What keeps your passion alive?
And that I said, it's our life. You can't stop living.
Right.
You can't stop creating. When we stop creating, that would mean we are dead.
Yeah.
And we're still alive.
Yeah.
We create art because we don't know what to do, what else to do in this life.
Yeah. It's a great answer. Well, thank you so much, Amelia. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. And thanks again so much to my special guest this week, conceptual artist Amelia Kabakov of art duo Ilya and Amelia Kabakov. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, this is part of a two-part series of interviews with Amelia. So do check out the first part of the series by visiting the guest page at itsaquestionofbalance.com. We talk about when Amelia and Elia first got together and started making work together, their early life in Russia, why they started creating total installations, and also about their wonderful art installation project with children around the world, The Ship of Tolerance. So if you go to itsaquestionofbalance.com, I'll put links to both their website and The Ship of Tolerance on both the podcast pages, and there'll be photographs and information about them. So I encourage you to go there, itsaquestionofbalance.com, to the guest page, and have a look and a listen. And if you want to know the actual websites for them, it's Elia-Emilia-Kabakov.com and shipoftolerance.com. Just to remind you again, Bookshop Santa Cruz has a great event coming up on Monday, June 25th at 7 p.m. when they welcome Jonathan White for a reading and signing of his new book, Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. This is a free event co-sponsored with the Santa Cruz Museum of Natural History. Jonathan White is an active marine conservationist, a sailor, and a surfer. In his award-winning book, Tides, he takes readers on a journey of discovery around the globe to witness the largest, scariest, and most amazing tides in the world. He travels to California to shadow the Mavericks competition, to the Arctic to shimmy down a hole in the ice with an Inuit elder, to China to witness the silver dragon, a 25-foot tidal bore that crashes its way up the 80-mile Kiantang River, to Mont Saint-Michel, France, to learn how the monks were inspired by the tide, and to the Royal Society of London to discover where the likes of Plato, Aristotle, Leonardo da Vinci, Newton, Descartes, and others have all been captivated by the tide. This free event is a great opportunity to meet author Jonathan White. So that's Monday, June 25th at 7 p.m. More information at bookshopsantacruz.com. Just to remind you also that It's a Question of Balance has a topic hour and a guest hour, so be sure to tune in to hear interesting on the street discussions too, and you can find those previous discussions on the street at the website under the tab topics on the homepage. We've had some really, really interesting topics and also some really interesting guests, so I encourage you to go to both of those pages and find out what we've been doing previously. Thanks again for joining me, and I look forward to speaking with you again next time.